Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Diana Deeney.
Hey, Diana. You know, we were chatting off air a little bit about one of the projects that you're working on with a client of ours and in getting the contracts in place and stuff like that. And it reminded me of that even when I worked within an organization, I was often working like a consultant as a reliability engineer. You know, we were unfortunately sometimes brought in too late or after a product has had a disaster and they bring in some reliability team. This is when I was at HP at corporate. And then they'd bring us in and say, what did we do wrong? How do we fix this? And we would always say, you should have called us when you started this project.
So, you know, I hear this all the time from a lot of reliability engineers. Does it matter what field you work in or what your company is producing? Like, I wish they would have called me earlier, is usually what I hear reliability engineers say.
Yeah. Now, if we could get that in a contract, per se, right? If it's some organizations have a lifecycle document that's provides a framework or a guideline for teams that are developing a new product. I have almost never seen reliability mentioned in the concept phase. Is that you need reliability expertise or you need to think through the reliability objectives and environment and constraints that you have at that very early stage.
I think that's usually assumed to be wrapped into the engineering
decisions. Yeah, you need to know how the assumptions go.
Yeah.
But it's not it might be set the requirements and then but it's written. And I've seen so many of these requirements documents where on page 17, it talks about it's a 2-year warranty. And in page 47, it talks about the cost of warranty can't go above so much money, which then translates to what's the probability of failure you're allowed to have. And then in page 17 or 847 is the environmental constraints, you know, scattered all over the document. But that doesn't, I mean, the requirements document is setting the framework. There's two documents I had in mind here. One is the lifecycle document that provides a guide to the program manager, essentially. If we had a call out in that, that said, no, you need somebody, whether it's a reliability engineer or not, that does, here's the goal and environment, create the reliability statement complete at that early stage, then it makes it a obligation or an expectation, if nothing else, that it gets done early in the program that then builds out to all kinds of stuff. What are you trying to do? How good does this product have to be? How long is it supposed to last and in what environment with what customers and so on? If that's not defined clearly in the concept phase, which I've rarely ever seen it done, is it gets lost then in the requirements document, which is the contract to the engineering team to say, this is what you got to build. It's got to be blue, weigh less than 3 pounds, blah, 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 blah. But if reliability is scattered across that, it becomes invisible then. And I think it gets lost. The other part I've ran into is that as reliability engineers, we often work as consultants. We might work out of the quality group or the manufacturing group or in a central team and then assigned to support a project, for example. And whether you're external consultant or internal consultant, you still got to build trust and people believe, you know, that you add value, that you actually are not an impediment and all these other things all still apply. And I think being an external consultant, we know that we're advisors. We're providing either, we're rolling up our sleeve and preparing samples for testing and running the test, or we're advising them how to construct a test and run it or facilitate an FMEA. But at the end of the day, that team, the program manager and that team has to make the decisions. And if somebody says, hey, Diana, we need this accelerated life test, we're concerned about the how long this new widget's going to last in our product, could you set one of those up? And you could advise them. You could actually probably run it for them in their labs or in an external lab, and you could make it happen. But the results go back to them, and they make a decision,
right,
whether it's good or not. But we create these contracts with them, even internally, saying, all right, director, you need this. When do you need it? What's the criteria for it? How many samples do I get to, you know, I'm going to ask for more samples than you have, but how many do I really get? There's a lot of details to work out. And that forms, in my mind, a contract. Then the director feels confident that they're going to get the information when they need it, and we can produce it. And I think it goes both ways. If you're in a reliability team and somebody says, hey, you need to go run this accelerated life test, and you don't think of it as a contract negotiation, you may miss a bunch of stuff that makes the results actually relevant to the director at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had to learn, becoming my own consultant, mm-hmm. I had to learn how to do contracts better. And, you know, marketing and sales and that kind mm-hmm. of thing, but really focusing in on, here's what they're asking for, but this is really what they need. And this is why it matters to them. Mm-hmm. And that whole workflow, I didn't really learn that until I was off on my own. And I didn't learn that when I was part of a quality and reliability engineering group. And I kind of wish I had looked at it that way. Even earlier on in my career, I think, not that anything went bad. I've had great experiences, but I think it would have been more valuable to the people I was working with if I took more of a consulting role and made it clear at the beginning. Am I a mentor to you? Am I providing a service that, you know, I'm going to mm-hmm. be producing a deliverable, or am I an expert who's helping you make some critical decisions?
Right.
And just, you know, all of that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. You just kind of outlined the three ways consultants are used. Sometimes we're just a pair of hands. We're there to prepare samples and run a test and take readings and, you know, measure stuff or do something. And other, like a pair of hands, if you get called in to facilitate an FMEA, you mm-hmm. are rolling up your sleeves and you facilitate, right? That's one way we work internally and externally as consultants. Another is you have some expertise. So like the accelerated life test design, you may or may not roll up your sleeves to do it, but you may be advising them on how to design it or design it yourself and then teach them what this means and what the constraints were and the pros and cons and so on. You bring in a set of expertise to get an accomplishment done, something done. And then there's coaching, mentoring type stuff, where you're a trusted advisor, you know, for an ongoing development of somebody or some team. Mm-hmm. And we still do that internally, you know, even if you're on a quality or reliability role. But you hit on a key thing I hadn't thought of in a long time. It's just becomes so innate, is usually the presenting problem. Oh, hey, Diana, we need this accelerated life test. Usually means there's more to it than that. They don't yeah. need a test run just for fun, just because we got a chamber. We should use that to do an accelerated test. Can you do something over there with that? No, they have a question that they think that ALT is the right answer for. And it may or may not be. You may be able to pull out a report saying, you know, let's use this. Here's the physics of failure model. It's exactly that failure mechanism. We can emulate it and simulate it here and then run a much fewer samples much quicker to validate it. Would that still solve your problem?
Yeah. It's the start of a conversation.
Right.
And you have to balance not being a pain. Like you want them to come to you with questions or suggestions. Hey, I need this. You know, you don't mm-hmm. want to be a roadblock. But it is the start of a conversation to find out if what the real problem is, or to help them reframe the problem that they're seeing to mm-hmm. to what might matter more. And in the end, like you said, maybe they just need an alt test, and mm-hmm. that's fine.
well, you know as well as I do, is there's, you could run an accelerated life test that takes 6 months, or you could run one that takes 3 days. It's, what do you need to know?
Yeah.
You know, what environment is this? What are the failure mechanisms you're worried about? Do we even know how it fails? If somebody hands me the, well, it was a sad story when, but I was interviewing a team for an assessment, and they were making a portable printer, a battery-powered portable printer for the traveling salesman type and client or customer. And I'm like, I don't know why you would want to do this, but whatever. And they said, if I give you, and he was literally picking up the one and only prototype they had mocked up. It was on this guy's desk, and he handed it to me. And I swear, it wasn't my fault, but we dropped it. And he, as he was asking me, he was, well, how long would this last?
as he was saying, how long would this last? And then you guys dropped it.
I said, about 3 feet. It's just shattered.
Well, what did he? I could just imagine. That's it's terrible. Like,
okay. And yeah, I didn't get the project. But if you're making a portable device, drop is important. You know, people aren't going to drop it. So that was, you know, a real story. It really happened, but it was like, okay, that didn't go well.
That was really funny.
But it brought up a discussion for me in every other request I would get is, you've got a whole system here. There are literally tens of thousands of ways this could fail, right? Which ones matter? You know, what's the risk assessment you've done? How well do you understand the use conditions and use profiles and stuff like that? You know, instead of, if alignment of the print, the bar that the print head travels on through vibration or shock or drop or any of that kind of stuff, or even thermal cycling, can put it out of alignment so you get poor quality stuff. Is that what you're after? Which is very different than how long's the battery going to last in normal use? How often do they need to recharge? Which is another way it fails. If I'm ready to print and the battery is dead, I can't print. It failed. And so on. You could go on and on and on. We could do an FMEA that would, you know, point out dozens of ways, or a fishbone diagram or whatever. It's part of that initial ask was, well, how long will this last? If I don't ask, well, how long do your customers expect it to last? I might test it for 3 years and say, oh, it lasts 3 years, but that's not relevant. It really was the expectation it should last 5 years or 10 years. And so, yeah. You know, and it's a completely different test if it's a 10-year test versus a 2-year test.
Yeah. And a lot of times that conversation is, as a reliability engineer, you know what kind of questions to ask, mm-hmm. or what you need to have answered in order to be able to answer their question. And sometimes that's another way to start the conversation is, you know, I need this. We'll, you know, just start talking to them and getting some of those initial questions asked so you can help reframe things at the end that conversation is important, and you're allowed to lead it. You don't just have to wait for somebody to come up to you with a problem either. Like if you know about a new product development, they're getting started with their PRD, and you're hearing, you know, whispers about a warranty of 5 years. I don't know. I would talk to somebody on the team while they're drafting the PRD. Yeah.
That's right.
Start asking some of these questions. Get it defined early.
What's new? What are the areas of most concern? He says, well, we haven't even started the design yet. All right. We're going from 1 year to 5 years, and it's an impact to the company's financials. What part has got to be robust enough to make it work? What keeps you up at night when you're just getting started? And then those discussions go a long way to, oh, we're bringing in this new vendor for this critical component, and we've never used this technology before. That's a red flag. Let's dive into that a bit. What does the vendor know? And so on. You can do all of that before you really build out the first prototype. But yeah, Carl and I talked about it in our book, where it was, it's part of it is that early concept phase and the early, even pre-FMEA stuff. What keeps you up at night? What are you worried about? Because we got to hit those long lead time pieces of it. It may take us a long time to get samples. It may take us a long time to mock up samples or test conditions. Or, you know, if we've never done, you were talking about it in the last episode, is a device going to be installed on the moon to check for seismic activity and et cetera. If we've never done that before and we're hallucinating what's the surface like, that might be a long discussion about what's really there. Is it really cheese? Is it dust? What do we know? But it's some things take a long lead time to effectively get the information or provide insights into the team. And other times, if it's just routine stuff, it's like, it's still a conversation. Why do we need to do this? Is it going to add value? Who needs this information and when?
Right. It has to be, you're asking questions that you need to ask, but it has to be toward an end. If everybody's just together talking, why are you even all talking?
Why are you bothering?
Yeah. Why are you there? You don't want to be the seagull. I used to work with a group that like corporate was north and manufacturing was south. Mm-hmm. So the design team was in the north and the manufacturing was in the south. And and the southern people, they called the northern people seagulls because they would fly down, make a mess of everything, and then fly back. So you don't want to be the seagull, right? You don't want to just fly in with all your questions and problems and say, well, it could fail this way and it could fail this way. And what about this? Did you think about that? And then you just dump on them and then walk away. That's not providing value. No. You do have to drive your conversations and your discussions toward what's going to be useful for the end product, for the customer, for the team to make decisions. So you do want to have that in mind when you're having a conversation, not just bringing up all the problems.
Yeah. And part of it, I mean, if you are embedded with a team and you're supporting this project or whatever, part of it is creating a more of a document, which I would call a reliability project plan. It's our reliability plan. And even better if it's incorporated into the requirements document or gets required into the program manager's plan for developing this program, this product. But it's, what do we need? What are the risks we're facing and how do we identify them and what are we going to do about it? What are our key decision points? You know, do we really need this accelerated life test? Well, let's do some research and figure out what we know and don't know and how important it is to fully understand it. Okay. And then on May 1st, then we'll decide, do we need to get samples together to do a test? That becomes a plan that is essentially a contract saying, this is what the reliability tasks are in order for us to get to a reliable product at the end of the process. And it will change. Contracts change. And here's our process for changing it. But it takes us to listen very carefully as to what's important, what are the constraints, how precise does it need to be, how do risk, because every program I've ever been on, I don't know about you, Diana, I'm sure none of your programs done it because they've been so well managed. Oh, we need this feature. We need this blue button over here. Or we need to add this thing to it. Or the customers really want this WYSIWYG on it. And it's only 2 weeks to go. Like, okay. Or this supplier just went out of business. We need to find another, you know, key manufacturing system here or whatever. That never happens, I'm sure.
It always happens on every project.
It's given. It's so the contract has to be, oh, here's our plan. We're going to run this set of tests. We'll get this many samples and we're done. No, it's not really adding much of any value. It's what's important, what's key, who needs what by when, and to what kind of, do I need a report? Do you need a presentation? Do you need a model? Do you need a simulation? What do you need in order to inform you to make a better decision? And then we come back with, well, this is how we recommend getting there. And then it's back and forth as the program develops, as the project evolves.
So I think that's a good idea. Generally, I think it's a good idea to do what you can to avoid surprises later. It could be surprises in the design decision you made, or it could be surprises in how you're working with your group. Mm-hmm. But now I was in a small group, and the design team kept making changes, like, let's add a widget, or let's do this, or like the timelines kept slipping or changing. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. it's typical stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was part of the manufacturing team, and we were all like trying reacting to every one of these changes.
Yeah.
And we're like, what if we set up like a contract? You know, this is what you're looking for. This is how, yeah, just to try. And so it was created, and I was the first one to use it. And the designer looked at me, and he threw it back at me. He said, "What is this? This is a CYA form." And I'm like, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So the way that you implement it is important. Like, don't surprise somebody. Like, all of a sudden you're drafting out a reliability contract. What is this? It just looks like a way to pin them down, to further constrain and create headaches for them, which is not what you're doing.
Not what you're trying to do, no.
Yeah, you're really trying to provide a service, to work with them, to provide some talking points and a conversation. So, I mean, just be open about, hey, I'd like to try this for this project. Just let them know what you're doing and have them be part of it. Otherwise, you're going to get the backlash like that.
Yeah, definitely.
And it'll just destroy some relationships, or... Yep. You'll have to buy them a cupcake or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Donuts. Engineers work for donuts.
Donuts.
No, we had in the consumer products I work with, there was always a spot where the design is locked down. It didn't mean it would never change. It just meant, here's the bill of material so that we can start sourcing it and have stuff in place so that we can actually manufacture it. So any change to the design that affected the supply chain was markedly more expensive at that point. So it really had to be justified. It wasn't a free-for-all design at that point. It was at this date, it gets locked down. And it was financial, because we don't want to buy 400 power supplies for our first run of this thing and then have to throw them all away because you change the design and we need a different power supply. Now it takes us another month to get one. Or like the ASICs on systems, there's a long lead time on some of those. So it's designs would phase into being locked down, often dependent on sourcing and not so much the reliability part of it. But we can leverage that and say, hey, look, if you want to run an accelerated life test on this critical component, we're going to need samples, and they might take 6 weeks to get here. And this test itself that you want looks like it's going to take 6 weeks to run. And you're going to launch this in 8 weeks? Okay. I think we have a problem, because we're not going to get you the information in time. But it's, unless you start looking at the give and take and the back and forth of it, we may do a perfectly good accelerated test that's immaterial because we've already launched and shipped.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's lots of factors into it, financials, personalities, which is always fun. The people part is fun. Financials is, well, they're like procurement engineers. I just don't want to talk about it. Just kidding. Just kidding. So if you're a procurement engineer or a financial person working with product development, you know, don't hate on me here. But if you do have a question, you know, we should extend that to you, or an idea of how to work better with reliability, you know, let us know. I'm going to try to get out of this one real quick.
Yeah. You're dancing pretty. Yeah.
But it is a contract, right? Whether we have it in a document or not, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, it's, don't spring them on a surprise. It may or may not ever be written down, yet even a handshake or a head nod saying, yeah, I'll get that for you, is a contract. You've committed to doing an FMEA or helping facilitate one or show up to this meeting or interview the supplier or whatever. Those are pieces of a contractual language. And the more formal it is up to the individual organization and the people involved, but it meeting your obligations, meeting your commitments is part of building trust. By doing it in a way that adds a lot of value, even better. So I think we need to think these things through and not just run the test and hope somebody uses it. It's to make sure it is valuable is go through that contracting process. What do you need by when? What's important?
And how do you need me to show up? You know, That's like right. we talked at the beginning, as a mentor, as a provider, you know, pair hands, or mm-hmm. as an expert.
Right.
That can help you frame the solution that you present to them too.
That's right. And it makes everything a whole lot clearer, never perfect, ever, yet clearer, and a lot less misunderstanding. So that's the idea here, is that we're talking about. All right, cool. Back to the questions. If you've been listening to this and going, oh, you forgot this, or what about that, and stuff like that, let us know. Or if you have a question on any other topic or idea or stuff that you're scratching your head on going, what about this? Let us know. We'd love to interact with you, get you some information or an answer back or insights, if nothing else. And then we'll most likely talk about it on one of the shows. And we do respect NDAs and all that good stuff. So we'll, but if you'd like to join the conversation directly, there is a way to do that over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. I have a SpeakPipe app set up on that, so you can record us a message.
It's really cool.
It is pretty cool. So we can include that in an episode. Besides that, there's a comment field there. You could just type something over to us. You could send us email. You can find us on LinkedIn or our about pages. And Diana and I and all of the hosts look forward to hearing from you as you we're extending the offer for you to join the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks, Diana. And I think we're at our obligation 20-25 minute time period here, maybe a little longer, but...
Oh, you know what? I just defaulted to you. That was part of our contract, right?
Yeah.
You were taking the timekeeper role? Yeah, timekeeper. I just blathered on when I needed to add something. Yeah.
There you go. It all works. Luckily, we're not doing a show that's, you know, limited to 18 minutes and 4 seconds or something like that.
Wow. What show is that?
Just think of it like a sitcom on TV with the 10 minutes of commercials interwoven in it. Oh. Old school TV.
Yeah, not streaming.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much, Diana. We'll get in touch again soon and do some more recording. Hopefully we get a handful more questions.
Yeah. Yeah. Please reach out, everybody. And it's great talking to you, Fred.
Yeah. Same, Diana. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.